are listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people waging struggle for love and revolution.
Meetups, meetup-esques, aguanu. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to Love and Revolution Radio. This is Sherry Mitchell. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in rainy Bunawebskik territory. We are located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And on this cloudy day, I have my bit of sunshine in my co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Today, we're going to talk to Rivera about her journey of the past year and about her brilliant works of fiction that have come out during the time that she's been away. Hello, Rivera.
Hi, Sherry, and it's great to be back on air with you for the first time in almost exactly a year. It's been quite a journey, and I just want to say that today is this beautiful high desert day with sunshine and winds, and the doors and the windows are wide open, and the bull snakes are slithering around, and the plum trees are blooming, and it just makes me deeply appreciative to be alive, which at this time last year, I wasn't sure I was going to be. So here we are, we're back, and let's talk a little bit about the journey of what's happened in this past year. It's been a big year all around, not just for you and me, but socially, politically. We've kind of gone through quite a year in terms of the current administration, the local challenges we're facing, the uprisings of movements. It's been a whirlwind.
Yeah, and I use you as an inspiration when I think about what we're going through, that we are really going through the healing of an illness in the body of society and in the minds of humanity. And so when I think about the journey that you've been on to bring your body back into a state of wellness, I like to think that that is a kind of a reflection of where we are hopefully going as a species of humanity, that we are moving through this process of healing and that we will come out into a greater state of wellness on the other side of it. And so thrilled by the progress that you've made in relation to your own health and well-being. I'm thrilled that you have the strength and fortitude to be such an example of healing for us in the world, because as we all know, healing crises are not easy to face, and you've faced your own with a lot of grace and with an incredible amount of strength, and shown us how to move through these things with a degree of beauty that I think is often missed in the midst of these healing crises. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the experiences that you've had through your own healing journey?
Yeah, just for any listeners who are dropping in now and haven't heard the news, this time last year, I was diagnosed with stage 2 ovarian cancer. Not the worst diagnosis you can get, but certainly a little bit more than the common cold. And we stopped doing the show so that I could focus entirely on healing, which was the correct decision to make at the time. I was so blessed in terms of the doctors that showed up in my life and even the entry point. I was not a big fan of Western medicine, but I was going to see a naturopath, and she was instrumental in saying, hey, something is seriously wrong here. You need to go and grapple with the Western medical system, which does a few things really well, and a crisis is something the Western medical system handles quite well. I think there's a lot to analyze in there in terms of systems and broader social, cultural, political systems and how they deal with crisis. But I would say that what really helped me through my journey is acknowledging the strengths of one system while being able to tap into the broad array of other practices that support and nurture the entire being. And so I would include my naturopath in that, and I would include the amazing support of friends and family. My 93-year-old grandmother called me every week with heart-based meditations and prayers to do. And one of the things that I found is that having an extreme illness like that, and this is something we could really reflect on for our larger social, political, cultural, economic crises that we're facing, is that anytime you're confronted with a crisis, it's an opportunity for digging deep, for re-looking at what's going on, for looking for a totally different alternative, for overhauling what you know already to be problems in your life or in the system, and having a little courage. Because if you're in a position like I was, or like I think many of our large systems are, being sick is not fun. It hurts. It saps your energy. It's frightening. You know something's wrong, but you don't know what it is. And generally, embracing a healing process is going to get you to a place that is quite a bit more lively, interesting, healthy, healthful. And one thing's for sure, you're not going to get there without taking the journey. So I think it's interesting that a lot of medicines are a little bitter, or they're a little painful. Healing processes are not easy, generally speaking, and they require us to change. So I'm coming back to Love and Revolution Radio in a very different place than I was when I left. I wouldn't say it's better or worse. It's just different.
Well, I think that right now, different is good. We have to learn new ways to be able to manage the conflicts and the crises that come up in our lives. Because I think oftentimes when we think about the paradigm that we're in, many times when dealing with Western medicine, the initial response is to go into warfare with the body and to amputate any parts that are not cooperating by the standards of Western medicine. And so looking at things in a more holistic way and looking at how we can work to harmonize what's going on within us is a different approach. And it's something that's moving more into the mainstream in regard to medicine. And we need to move that more into the mainstream in regard to the way that we solve some of the larger problems that we're facing. And I also want to, recognize the fact that, while you were going through this process, you wrote a whole new book by hand with pencil and paper and put out another brilliant piece of work that is designed to help guide us through this process. The book that I'm holding in my hand, which I love and will continue reading over and over again, along with the first book in the trilogy, is The Roots of Resistance. And this is book two of the Dandelion trilogy that, to me was revolutionary in and of itself, that you have created these works of fiction that are really right on the fringes of the reality that we're facing and shared these stories of real people with real relationships who are working in real time through these pretty catastrophic challenges that the society in which the characters are living. And that's not any different than the reality that we're facing right now, even though it's not an exact mirror. In many ways, it does mirror the process that we're going through. When we think about the function of mirror neurons in our brain, that they fire in exactly the same way when there is a telling or retelling of a story, even if the person who is hearing the story wasn't there to be an eyewitness or participant in the experience. So when we read these stories that you're sharing with us so generously, the mirror neurons in our brain are firing in exactly the same way as they would fire had we been there participating in the experiences. And it prepares us for being able to show up and to function in ways that the characters are working through some of these things so that we can be able to bring the experience of the story into our everyday lives. So tell us a little bit about the roots of resistance and what the writing process, I first would like to know, what was the writing process like as you were moving through your own path towards wellness? What was the writing process like for the roots of resistance during that time?
That's a great question. And I just want to acknowledge that I agree with you that our stories are our practices for our life. And that which we practice is usually what we manifest in a pinch in our life. So we have to be really careful about what stories we're telling. We see how stories that we've told over and over again about conquest or violent warfare tend to show up again and again in our lives, often in not very productive ways. And so when I sit down to write a story, I try to be aware of that, that we're trying to unravel old patterns and reweave new patterns. When I looked at writing The Roots of Resistance, it was a sequel to The Dandelion Insurrection. And so it picked up where the first book left off, at a moment of possibly disaster, possibly triumph for the movement, where they had successfully ousted the corporate dictatorship from power, and they were standing poised at a moment where they didn't know if they would live through that moment and enjoy their victory or they wouldn't. And I would say that the sequel gives you a little bit of both, that there were some consequences for their actions that were both good and hard. And so the story begins in The Roots of Resistance with looking at what happens when you open a power vacuum but don't have a really clear plan for what's going to step into that opening. So the Dandelion Instruction has some surprises along the way, and they actually have to deal with the fact that who takes power is not necessarily them. It's a group that looks pretty friendly to them at first, but they find out that you can be deceived by those good looks. And you asked about the writing process, and I would say that I do a lot of research before I write a novel like this. I love to look up the stories of nonviolent action and really borrow from them quite liberally, because these are our modern-day myths, our modern-day hero stories are rooted in the collective struggles that have gone on in all kinds of people all over the world. I learn a lot about the field, and then I weave it into the story. Some new concepts that show up in The Roots of Resistance are things like civilian-based defense, which is nonviolent in its orientation and is able to protect nation states from internal or external coups. So I love learning about that, and I love to put it in the books.
The book deals with some complex human relationships and about walking a line in many instances between being distrustful and oftentimes angry and trying to move back towards open-heartedness in those relationships. And so as we're facing the challenges of our day, which are many, and also require us to manage these really difficult relationships with those who seem to be so polarized, and also with those who are engaging in activities that are really harming a number of other people and are harming life. What can the book teach us about managing our relationships with one another as we face these types of challenges?
I think there's several levels to that the book looks at that from, and that we also can look at that. The book has a lot of balance between what we might call the pragmatic approach to nonviolent action and the principled. And the principled approach often takes into account the fact that human beings are not just a bunch of levers and mechanics in terms of systems operation. We're pretty complex. We have feelings, we have emotions, we have spiritual dimensions. And the characters in the Dandelion Insurrection come up against some real thresholds in terms of their internal preparation for the conflicts that they find themselves in personally. They have this large conflict going on with the new regime that slides its way into power. And that's a pretty oppositional relationship, and yet it's a tricky one, because many of the people in the country are convinced that the new regime is the ally of the movement. So there's a lot of truth-telling that has to be done from the movement's perspective. But in the midst of that, they also have some internal problems come up in the movements, in terms of a flank that's using tactics that are not approved by other parts of the movement, and friction that arises between a new character, Will Sharp, and one of our tried and true favorites, Charlie Ryder, in terms of what it means to take effective action on defense, in defense of and on behalf of that which you love, whether that's your community, the environment, your family, your love of your life. How do we, especially in this particular dynamic as men, in the characters in the book, how do we stand up for the things that we love in a way that aligns with our integrity, and why do we make the choices that we make in terms of that? Every character that I write about, I try to really put, bring their perspective to the forefront with integrity. And I think that's a lesson we can think about for our own movement work, that we often want to make superficial villains out of our opposition. We want to make them into Disney cartoon villains, right? With the black cloaks and the wah-ha-ha-ha. But the reality is much more complicated, that people tend to be people, almost no matter who they are, and they have motivations and reasons for what they're doing. And while we may completely disagree with both their actions and their motivations, understanding them can often help us become very effective in the change work that we want to try to accomplish. On a very large example, if you're dealing with a dictator, some dictators seek power because they love power. Other dictators seek power because they love money. Others seek power because they are thrust into it and they don't really want to be there. There's a broad spectrum of why people end up becoming oppressors. And when you can identify what's motivating that person, you can meet the need that's underneath that, redirect the need that they have, they think they have, or thwart them if you have to, on what they're trying to accomplish through a method that is causing intense suffering. So one thing I've learned looking at the field of nonviolent struggle is that the more you can learn about the many dimensions of being human that exist, the more effective you're going to be, because you're not dealing with nuts and bolts. You're really dealing with people. And on one level, you can really look at all conflicts as needing to repair the relationships in those conflicts. If there's a CEO, for example, who's denying living wages to the workers, that relationship between those two groups is very fraught. It's very strained. It's not in peace. It's not in balance. It's something that does need to be brought to the surface, cleaned out, transformed. And doing so may actually be to the greater advantage of all the parties involved, including the CEO. But the things that might come to the forefront of as being an advantage may not be the things that that CEO has really looked at emphasizing in his own life. So this is kind of one of the themes that I got to explore more in depth in The Roots of Resistance, is the role of our relationships and our hearts in the work that we are doing.
You know, I think that that's such an important thing. When I teach my trauma workshops, one of the things that I talk about in the second day of those workshops is about being able to recognize that we have been trained not only to view the world through this lens of separation in regard to one another, but also in relation to ourselves, that we break ourselves up into these fragmented, commodified, saleable parts. So you're talking about the CEO who has to, you know, go and do this job and make these decisions, and that they're often separated from the core integrity that this individual might choose to live with otherwise. We see that all the time where someone says, oh, I'm just doing my job. And one of the things that I think is really important in this time that we're in is for people to become empowered to carry their integrity and to embody the whole of who they are in all that they're doing. And so when we think about that fragmentation within ourselves, that we've become broken down into all of these different saleable pieces, how do we eliminate that illusion within ourselves so that we can act with integrity in all that we're doing, so that we don't have to feel that we have to leave our personal beliefs at the door, because those personal beliefs are what inform our actions in the world. And so I think that's a really important piece of looking at how do we, you know, move away from these disconnected acts of harm, whether it be to one another or to the environment or to other beings in the natural world. How do we move away from our disembodied action so that we can once again be acting as fully embodied, heart-based human beings who are living in relation with other living beings throughout the entire creation?
I think that's the core question of our time, really. And in many ways, I think it has to do with being willing to be vulnerable, to be empathetic, to be intuitive, to open those dimensions of ourselves. And let's be honest, that can be scary work for people in the broader westernized culture. When I looked at this in The Roots of Resistance, in the contrast between the characters of Will Sharp, who is the ringleader of a violent flank to the movement, and Charlie Ryder, who is pretty firmly committed to nonviolence. And they have a lot of conflict and a lot of tension between each other, between them. But one of the things that they share very deeply is a profound sense of their responsibility to care for and protect that which they hold dear. And along the journey of the story, Will Sharp runs up against his sense of betrayal of what he had held to be dear to him, and how it came into conflict with other things, like how his boss sent him in to do a task, let's say, without any spoilers, that really violated his sense of integrity that children should be protected. All children should be protected. And it causes him to question his loyalty. And when we look at these characters, one of the things that both young men are on a journey of discovering is how to be sensitive and intuitive and interconnected with the people that they love in a culture that has taught both of them, not just Will Sharp, but both of them, that strong men must shut down. They must have armor over their hearts. They must be willing to do what it takes to protect that which they love. And Charlie is learning to question that narrative, to question that there's a dichotomy between those two things. And I have to give some props back to you, Sherry, because our conversations about the role of the warrior in your traditional cultural understanding really opened my eyes, along with what happened at Standing Rock and their framing of warriors, to the many definitions that can come when we choose to take that strong protective stance. It doesn't mean that we have to crush the other person into the ground. It does mean we need to take pretty solid action that raises the stakes in the conflict and maybe makes the other person stop and think twice about whether or not they want to cross the line that they've been barreling towards. And so, you know, I've learned a lot from our conversations that has really woven into the books. And I think one of those aspects that we could talk about is the character of Ginup.
Yes, Ginup is a word within our warrior tradition that means helper. And so we've talked about that particular philosophy attached to that. A warrior is really a helper and a protector. And so when we think about helper, we think about Ginup, and when we think about protector, we think about Smogness. And so I was really thrilled that you incorporated this character of Ginup into the story. Go ahead and tell the listeners about Ginup.
Well, I think it's really a shared telling, but originally I like to put characters into my novels that are based on, sometimes more so and sometimes less so, based on people that I know and have met who have very much inspired me in my life, so I'll work them into a character. And when I came to you and said, Sherry, I want to put a tribute character in the new novel to you, we had a bit of discussion about who this character would be and what the name of the character should be and what their task and roles should be. And I really wanted to make sure that this character that I wanted to weave into the book was rang true for both of us, that it wasn't just based on my experience looking at you and everything that I admire and see and perceive, but also if she was going to be an Indigenous woman standing up for social justice, in this case water rights, as an Indigenous rights lawyer in the context of a fictionalized story, that it was also something that rang true to your perspective. And so in the book, Hina shows up at a resistance encampment as a legal counsel, as a organizer, and she becomes a very strong figure for Will Sharp on his journey of trying to figure out how to be that kind of protector without necessarily having to cause direct physical harm to the other person, and to really give him some thoughts and concepts that were very new to him in his experience and really was a turning point in his life at that moment, a turning point that comes back in the context of the plot in a really pivotal and important way.
Well, it was really fun for me to read that portion, and I know that we had some discussion about the portrayal, because one of the things that is really important when I think about the individuals who have inspired me in relation to our warrior traditions, there's always a gentleness underlying what it is that they're trying to communicate with others. And when they're trying to instruct somebody, there's a real beauty and gentleness associated with that. And it was really important to me that that was somehow portrayed in the telling of that story. The elders that we have are oftentimes so gentle and so beautiful, but they're so powerful. And the things that they're able to share with us and teach us when we work with them in the simplest ways, where we think we're just helping them stack firewood and we come away with this really profound teaching, or, you know, we're helping them to prepare for ceremony. And in the process, we're learning so much about our interrelatedness with the medicines that we are caring for and that we carry. And so, you know, I really want to thank you for including that piece in there, because I think that it's important for people to know that there's so many different forms of strength, and that strength, like the word warrior, has often been associated with force that is oftentimes, you know, really aggressive or violent. And so when you're working on these parts of the books that are dealing with these different forms of strength, what thought process did you go through in relation to understanding the distinction between different forms of strength and how those forms have been portrayed to the larger society through the stories that we've told throughout our history, and how your work crafting this new story might portray strength in a different manner?
Yeah, well, one of the things about our process around the character of Kinap is in the revision process that you gave me some very specific feedback around the ways that she was showing up in the initial draft with a lot of anger or ferocity. And not that either one of those is bad in a general sense or in specific instances, but you were opening the door of my perception to this other way of teaching, instructing, showing up, all of that which you just described so beautifully. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID. the things that a novel has really given, or novel writing has really given me a lot of appreciation for, is understanding that every hero's journey is really a collective story. There's no such thing as a lonely hero, really. That every time Charlie Ryder tried to cast himself into that lonely struggle, really he couldn't get himself out of the messes he would make for himself. He was part of a movement, part of a team, and in our movements, we really want to celebrate all the different skill sets, all the strengths, all the ways of organizing, all the roles that people play. And I think that's something that I really tried to emphasize in the sequel to the Dandelion Insurrection, that we have characters like Ida Robbins, a teacher, an elementary school teacher, who really brought forward some powerful modes of resistance, including constructive program or resistance education or parallel institutions. When they shut down her school, they opened a different school. And the character of the mouse is a new character. Her name is Alex Kelly, and she works for the federal government as a technician, someone who fixes the computers of the Congress members, basically. And she was able to bring forth so many different modes of resistance that we often overlook. We know from the field of nonviolent resistance that people like Alex Kelly are vital to many struggles that are dealing with corrupt regimes or invading armies, that there's often an invisible army, I guess, nonviolent army of people who are working in the halls of power to make sure justice moves through the channels of power and bureaucracy, and that injustice gets stalled, that it drags its feet, that it can't proceed. And so she works as a whistleblower twice in this book. She helped build the alternative internet that appears in the story. And in toward the end of the sequel, she and Tucker managed to pull off a rather crucial form of resistance that it has to do with the federal workers refusing to cooperate with an injustice. And I think this really brings up one thing about struggle that we often completely forget, which is that that the characters who show up in a movement may not be your most expected ones. But that doesn't mean they will be any less effective than what we might deem an activist. In fact, they may even be more effective.
I think that that's really a reflection of life, that we often find that our help comes from the most unlikely sources, and that we have been seeing alignment amongst people in the world that would have seemed incredibly unlikely before. We're seeing movements that are joining forces that would not have worked collaboratively in the past coming together, and also seeing many people who we never would have imagined championing hate doing so now publicly in many different forums around the world. I wanted to ask you, you had talked about in the Dandelion Insurrection that the story was one step from the reality that we face. Do you feel in the writing of The Roots of Resistance and in the changes that have transpired since the first book that we are now closer to the reality that you're portraying?
I would say yes, but in a surprising way. Many people read The Dandelion Insurrection right now, today, and think the illegitimate president refers to Donald Trump. The book was written 4 years ago, and it was really not necessarily a projection of Donald Trump specifically. I think in many ways, many of our presidents on both the left and the right, and their administrations and our Congress members, have really lost their legitimacy in the eyes of the people that they're supposed to be serving. And so many things in the Dandelion Insurrection have come surprisingly true. Things like the mass surveillance system, we all now know about it thanks to Snowden, but when I was writing the Dandelion Insurrection 4 years ago, it was only a suspicion. I would say that, you know, the problems that I was looking at and projecting forward in the Dandelion Insurrection, many of them have escalated and become more well-known. Problems that weren't really as well-known 4 years ago have become much more prominent. We have some things going on now that I didn't predict, neither in the first book nor in the writing of the second. I didn't predict that people themselves in real life would be coming out of the woodwork to join movements. One thing that I did sense brewing between the first and second book was the problematic phenomenon of the Democratic Party's co-option and deflation of movement energy. And I think this is really important to talk about. It's really hard to talk about because we want the Democrats to be good. We want them to be a great progressive party. We want to think that everyone who is channeling all of our movement activity into legislative action pretty much primarily or exclusively is really doing it from the best interests in their heart. But I think one of the things we have to really look starkly at is that the legislative action channel is only one of the many arenas that we need to take action within. We have to work culturally. We need to work economically. We need to work in terms of overhauling the way our politics is done, not just using politics as usual to try to get our way through a broken system. So some of those themes wound up strongly showing up in the new regime government, the interim government in the Roots of Resistance, and the character of John C. Friend, a politician who looks like he's your friend while he's really stabbing you in the back. That we need to be a little more savvy and aware of these patterns because our movements keep getting sold out on their real goals. And if we don't resolve this challenge, we are not going to make the strides forward that we need. We're not at the point where we need baby steps. We need strides in the right direction. And so I put a few warnings in the Roots of Resistance in regards to that.
I think that's a really critically important point because it really deals with our childlike dependence on some paternal force. And so many of us often have left our future in the hands of others who we felt were power brokers or, you know, even these kind of parental figures. In many ways, people look at the government as a parental figure. You know, what are you going to do for me? How are you going to take care of me? When are you going to solve my problems? And one of the things that we have to be careful about, because just as the projection of hate onto another group, you talked about turning those who oppose us into these, you know, kind of caricaturized villains, that we also project this kind of savior image onto are governmental figures. Oftentimes we think of them as, you know, the one who's going to come along and save us all. It's kind of this messiah complex.
That's such a good point.
Yeah, I think that it's important for us to remember that we do have a responsibility for the way that the world is now. We do have responsibility for the way that the world is going to be in the future. And we have to really mature as a society and let go of this childlike dependence and recognize that we have to begin doing the things that we want to see happening in the world and stop putting all of our power in the hands of those who are misusing it. And I think that the whole debacle, not only with the co-opting of movements, but with the taking away the voice of Democratic voters in the last primary election is a real clear indication that this system is not designed to support or represent us. And the only way that we are going to change that is for us to step up and to make the changes that are required, which means taking the power that we've given to them back and utilizing it in a way that actually moves us closer to our goal. So thank you for bringing that up. I think that's really important.
Well, I think that it's a pretty well-known dynamic that when we have an oppressor or an oppressed situation, that they coexist. They they arise together, and that does not mean it's a peaceful arising. I mean, it can be coerced, it can be manipulated, it can be beaten into people, it can be sanctioned onto people. But one thing we do know is that in every resistance struggle we've seen, when the oppressed refuse to go along with that system any longer, the oppressor has to adjust. They have to start changing. And sometimes the reaction is to try to repress further to get the oppressor to the oppressed to step back in line. But the goal of a movement is to withdraw your cooperation, your mental slavery, your economic support, your political support, and the tried and true mechanisms that we keep using over and over. We need to remove consent and cooperation from the systems of injustice. And that's the way that we break through both the larger stalemates that we face and this childlike dependency that you so accurately described. We enable the injustices by refusing to look at where our true sources of power lie. I think that's a really good description of what goes on. Oftentimes we do that out of ignorance, but then once our ignorance is taken away, once we know how to pick up and hold our power, how to withdraw consent, how to refuse cooperation, what holds us back then is a little bit of a deeper issue of complacency or fear is another thing that comes up. And so that's one thing I like to write about a lot, is getting into the heart of what is keeping our injustices in place. Once our ignorance is dispelled, and I don't mean ignorance in a negative sense, just when we are not aware of our options, what can we find underneath that? And how transformative can that area be? Because if we're stuck in a childlike dependency, or if we're stuck in an injustice, there's a part of our soul or our self or our being that is not being allowed expression. And it often is yearning to, it's wanting to burst out of its cage, out of its confinement, and come into full expression as what we're meant to be as human beings. And I find these kind of stories very juicy as characters in both fiction and in real life.
You know, I'm so impressed by one of the kind of cliched phrases that you used in the book, because it really talks about how do we look for the good examples out in the society and model our behavior after them. And so when I got to chapter 22 and saw you using the phrase, let's be frank about this, I was just delighted with it. I guess it just made me laugh every time I read it, because that's really what we need to be doing. We need to be looking for the examples of the way forward, and then we need to be incorporating them into our daily practice. So can you talk about how you use the phrase, let's be frank about this, in the book?
Certainly. And, you know, this is another good example of where a story I heard in real life inspired me to put a fictionalized version in the book. And it comes out of a story that you told me about a resistance struggle to a fracking operation in New Brunswick, I believe, wherein a truck driver was approached with compassion, respect, and dignity by the Native-led resistance over and over and over again, until a moment of transformation occurred within that truck driver's heart. And he said, I don't want to hurt your children either. I don't want to hurt my children. I don't want to hurt your children. I'm just stuck. And so in the novel, I put in a character named Frank Navarro, who is a drilling rig driver. His job is to get the drilling equipment to where they're going to drill into a watershed and extract the water. And he's confronted with the Dandelion Insurrection that's participating in a Native-led resistance to this. It's blockading a bridge. And they have treated him with respect and dignity every day of that long struggle. And when push comes to shove, when he's supposed to get off the bridge so that the private security can basically mow protesters down, He refuses. He turns his truck crossways across the road. He throws the keys out to the resistance movement, and he lets himself get arrested. This action, in turn, when it's reported on in the resistance news via the alternate, triggers a whole chain reaction of people who say, "Let's be frank. Let's be frank." And they take their cars out to road and they blockade the roads to resistance and extraction sites that are happening all over the country in the story. And it's this moment of movement magic that we like to think is just the stuff of stories, but in reality happens over and over and over again. And it really goes back to those mirror neurons that you spoke about in the beginning of the show, Sherry, that we are wired for empathy as human beings. And there are a small percentage of human beings who are sociopaths who do not have empathy neurons, but most of us do. And what happens to us in struggle, in resistance, in conflict, is that we actually have a tendency to want to empathize with each other. We want to understand what's going on. We want to try to resolve the conflict. And so when we are approached on either side of a conflict with respect and dignity, we seek ways to resolve that conflict more peacefully and less violently. But when we are approached with demonization, alienation, making people not human but into monsters, then we start the stuff of war. We start to make people not human so that we can go and then attack them without triggering our empathy neurons and our mirror neurons as powerfully. So in Let's Be Frank, we're reversing that warfare pattern. Right from the start, the movement makes a choice to reverse those patterns, to actually try to trigger our empathy for one another. And the ripples of that go out all across the nation. And as I said, this is not just the stuff of stories. This is a dynamic that happens quite frequently. And what you brought up about Let's Be Frank is that moment where each one of us, looking at a resistance moment that may be happening far away from us, we decide that our integrity is asking us to step up to the challenge and change our lives to take action to help resolve the injustice, whether it's moving your money out of a bank that's financing fossil fuels or deciding to shop locally to support your local farmers or to join with your local people of color-led movement to challenge your police department to drop its racist policies in policing. All of these things are happening because we were built to care. I think that's magic. I think it's amazing. It's transformative. But we truly are built to care and to use that power to help resolve our conflicts towards greater justice in our world.
Yeah, I think that's so important to understand the power of modeling. And when we think about other movements throughout history, some of the most seminal moments in those movements were moments that others amongst the group criticized the leaders for because they really wanted to propel the movement forward in a way that crushed whatever the opposition was. And what those leaders did was they created space for the other side to move toward them. And so when we think about creating that kind of space, it really is opening the doorway for that individual's humanity to come forward. And that's, to me, what is represented in that story and in the original story that we talked about that resulted in that shift in the gentleman up in Canada. And when we make space for other people's humanity to come forward, what we do is we allow for the possibility of increase within our own movements because we're inviting them to come closer to actions that are oriented towards life and towards heart-based connection. And I think that that's the piece that's often missing when we get into activist stances that are really based in models of conquest. And we've talked a lot about conquest activism, which is a term that I've coined years ago and have used quite a bit.
Well, and we're going to get a great chance to talk about that next week when we look a little more closely at your book that you've been writing about it with.
Yeah, and I want to move into this next piece because I want to make sure we have time to talk about the way that these shifts occur. In chapter 29, you also talk about people having this sense of hopelessness that combusts into hate, and how the projection, you know, of that sense of hopelessness onto the other causes the individuals to really look at them with hatred and with anger. And I want to talk a little bit about how that shift toward hate impacted those in that particular scenario, because when they shifted towards hate and their actions started to change, it changed the whole dynamic of what was happening. So I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a great scenario. It's a repeating motif that happens within situations of injustice. That in the way it's portrayed in the book, and there are variations, they don't all happen this way. The regime is repressing the movement and the populace more and more heavily. And this moment of hope that they had when the Dandelion insurrection initially succeeded, it deflates, it collapses. And as this goes on, the people feel like their options are being cut off more and more by the government's non-action, the government's refusal to act towards justice. And they feel like the movement is not succeeding in its goals using its nonviolent tactics. And through frustration and through some other factors that are going on, some people in the movement turn to sabotage, to violence, and to smaller acts of property destruction. These all end up backfiring on the movement in ways that make it harder for the movement to succeed overall. There are times and places when these tactics have been effective. In this particular instance, and that's true in many movements, it backfires on them and it enables and justifies the further repression of the governmental regime on the movement. And that very nearly, both literally and figuratively, kills them. And so what then has to transpire is they have to reground, and this is where the title comes from, The Roots of Resistance. They have to reground who they are and what they're about and why they're working for what they're working for in something stronger than hate. And the only thing I know that can be more powerful than hate is the power of our love. And oftentimes when we find ourselves on the edge of hate, it's actually because we feel that which we love is being violated. And we have two choices at that crossroad. We can put on our armor and go into battle and use hate as our sword, or we can cast aside the armor and use love as our illuminating light that draws everyone around and helps us reweave the entire human fabric. My personal perspective is that love in the short and the long run is the more effective tactic. That when you lash out with hate, that comes back to haunt you. Maybe not right away, maybe in a few years, maybe in a decade, but it's coming back around. And so if we want to move ourselves into a world of justice, equality, respect, and freedom, it behooves us to make our means and our ends this one and the same, and to put love at the forefront of our movement.
Beautifully said, my friend, beautifully said. And so when we think about the types of things that move us toward that sense of hopelessness, we can come up with a million examples. So let's talk about what are the things that move us back toward hope. What are some of the things that we can look for? What are some of the things that we can do in order to move us back toward hope so that we regain our sense of power and our confidence in being able to create the type of changes that we want to make?
I think hope, when it's firmly rooted, is built on love of that which we hold dear, and also vision of what could be. And that when we have love and vision, that's actually enough. that's enough to carry us through the challenges that we face. But if we don't have those two things, it's very easy to succumb to despair. So I spend as much time rooting myself in solutionary ideas and inspiring people, and also staying connected with and grounded in that which I love, as I do paying attention to the news of the injustices that are going on. Joan Baez said action is the antidote to despair, but I think a qualifier to that is putting your heart into that action. That if we're only acting from our fear, our hate, our rage, our sorrow, we're only taking in half of our strength and our power as human beings. And when we activate our vision, hope, and love, we really get the tools that will carry us through. And they can't be airy-fairy ideas. They need to be tangibly grounded. You need to be able to invoke the faces of the people you love. You need to touch the places that you love and hold dear. You need to sit in the, or walk or hike in the natural environment that you're struggling to protect from a pipeline. You need to ground yourself in what your culture could be if it was healthy and in balance with the rest of creation. And, you know, these are actually things that I brought up in The Roots of Resistance when the characters had hit their walls and hit their despair. They had to turn and look for those things and invoke them strongly. But once they did, and once they were able to move in that place, some really powerful transformative energy was unleashed, not just in them, but throughout the ripple effects through the whole movement.
Well, I want to thank you because you are an inspiration, and you also give us hope and provide guidance for the movements that we are all engaged in, wherever they may be and whatever they may look like. And so I want to thank you on behalf of myself and all of our listeners for being the human being and the bright light that you are in the world.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry, and thanks for agreeing to put Love and Revolution Radio back on the air in a whole new focus and energy and joie de vivre, I think is a good word to throw in there. And we'll be so glad to talk about your book and continue on with these great, beautiful, wonderful ideas as our show keeps moving forward. I need you to be love, 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 love,
love and revolution. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to you, Sherry, for putting the show back on air and for being my awesome co-host and bringing up so many insightful thoughts. You can find out more about Sherry and her writings at sacredinstructions.life. We do have a Love and Revolution Radio Facebook page. Give us a like and you'll find the podcast there, podcast links there. This weekly radio program can be broadcasted on local radio stations. Just talk to your station manager about that. And we are reachable through Love and Revolution Radio page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And if you are a Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes listener, you can find us at our show name, Love and Revolution Radio.